I would like right away to give the floor to Kate Dews on my left-hand side. She's, among other things, coordinating the Ireland Regional Office of the Peace Foundations for more than 30 years now, if I'm right. And she's also with the Advisory Committee on Disarmament and Arms Control. She's been with the International Peace Bureau, among other things, as a vice president. And most of all, she has been a pioneer of the World Code Project itself, presenting a doctoral thesis on this, the history of this project. You can see a copy over there, which is really very impressive. As I was witnessing this process myself, we can still call it a success story for the NGO anti-nuclear movement, and she has been working on this, and we're happy that she's with us now. So, Kate, you have the floor, please.
Thank you very much. Distinguished delegates and fellow peaceniks, it's such a joy to be back here, to see our elders ranged here, to acknowledge the elders who have passed away, who have been part of this, and I want to in particular pay tribute to Harold Evans, who turned 90 just a week before he died in Easter of this year. And I want to bring greetings from our Prime Minister, who's extremely supportive of this World Court project, and from Pauline Tangiora, one of the Māori elders from New Zealand, who was very much part of what we did here as well. And there are many New Zealanders who would like to be with you. Already we're dominating. I think we've got five of us here, which isn't bad from the other side of the world. So I've only got 15 minutes, so I'm going to keep it very short. If you want the long version, read the thesis. If you want the shorter version, this one is available as well. But there are a lot of anecdotes. It took us a long time to get to the court, and it was certainly not easy. But we built on a long history of peace activism, and there are some people, I can't name all of them, but there are some that we need to pay tribute to in particular, because actually, when Harold was starting this in 1986, he built on what a lot of other people had done before. And I have to acknowledge Sean McBride as an International Peace Bureau president. In his Nobel laureate speech in 1974, he called for outlawing nuclear weapons and having a convention. He was involved in the International Commission of Jurists and the establishing of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy in 1982. And he was involved with Richard and I think Peter was there as well, Richard Falk, in the London War Crimes Tribunal in 1985, when they actually called, one of the resolutions was to have an advisory opinion. He also started the McBride Appeal, which aimed to get 30,000 to 40,000 signatures from lawyers around the world, and he succeeded in 1988 in getting 9,000 signatures, mainly from non-aligned countries. But it's interesting to know that one of the ICJ judges at the time, Bajawi, who became the president, actually signed that. And many of the people in this room also signed it. So by 1992, there were 11,000 from 56 countries. And that was a really impressive start in terms of the lawyers and having that petition and the signatures ready to go when we finally got to the court. Harold Evans had a history of being, he actually worked at the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal. He was secretary to an earlier prime minister in New Zealand and a magistrate. He built on New Zealand taking France to the World Court in 1973. Yeah, they can't see Harold. But he also wrote letters to the government on nuclear policy. And in 1986, Professor Richard Falk visited Christchurch, and that photo, I think, was taken in my sitting room, when he told us to take the nuclear policy, our New Zealand nuclear policy, to the World Court. And, of course, Harold got very excited by this idea and all the wonderful work that LCNP had done on arguing that nuclear weapons were illegal, that he followed him all round New Zealand. And then a few months later, he went across to Australia, and I think he met a professor at Monash University, would I be right? And that professor, who's Judge Weeramantry, actually advised him to go for the advisory opinion at that point. So you've got a lot to answer for, Judge. And Harold wrote two open letters, the case for the World Court, one to the Prime Minister of New Zealand and Australia in 1987 in March, and one in May to all the 72 countries that had missions in Australia and New Zealand. He got 22 responses, some of them from non-aligned movement, but the Russians were interesting. They actually came and visited him in his home. Now, Harold had these six wise men, as he called them. There didn't seem to be many women around. We were good at making the tea and typing letters, but I'm being unfair. But these six wise men were the ones that wrote the original open letter, and you can see who one of them is. I'm not supposed to be highlighting his role, but, of course, Richard and Christopher Weeramantry are the only two of those six alive. And, of course, it's a wonderful contribution that they did that. Very briefly again, of course, New Zealand government at the time was pretty cautious, Australia was negative, but we did have interest from some countries, but until the end of the Cold War, actually none of the countries would take it on, really, with any vengeance. So we had to go and build support from the non-governmental groups, and we got the IPPNW New Zealand, UNA, the Advisory Committee on Disarmament, and in 88 I went to the Special Session on Disarmament and met the Indians and Swedes and others, and met LCNP people, and we also mentioned it at the UN. The Congress from IPPNW passed resolutions, IPB passed a resolution, and the International Association of Lawyers all around 88, 89, and that was partly to do with Harold and Kiwi doctors just going to those meetings and being really stroppy and persistent. I think it was Richard that said, Richard Falk said, the gleam in Harold's eye was a bit too bright. But thank you, Harold, for having a bright gleam. Harold, I think, came back through and saw Ron McCoy in Malaysia, and you went to the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting and had a go at them. I mean, may as well go to the top. And you did. And you did a lot in Malaysia. And Harold then drafted a UN resolution and got the Commission of Jurists in support as well. That's the UN Special Session on Disarmament, and that's the three Kiwis around the kitchen table. When we briefed Alan before he went, Alan Weir went to Geneva in 1991 and said, what can I do while I'm there? I think you rang and said, which mission shall we go to? And you went to about six or seven, and I'll never forget the fax coming through the machine at home saying, some of them are interested, including Costa Rica, and the guy from Costa Rica had done his PhD, I think, on international law and advisory opinions. So it was a wonderful find. So Alan went there in March 1991. He inspired me to then go in June to Geneva, and I joined up with Colin Archer from the IPB. We had interest from non-aligned states who said you have to have at least 50 countries involved in this, and they gave us wonderful guidance. And in fact, Zimbabwe, as you know, took leadership. In fact, most of those states that are up there took leadership. We went over to the World Court, we went over to Britain, and we got support from a lot of international groups there as well. And the World Court Project UK formed, which was absolutely key. And then the International Peace Bureau said, let's launch this World Court Project together with IPPNW and ALANA in 1992. Keith Motherson from Britain also needs acknowledging. He wrote a book called From Hiroshima to the Hague for Peace Activists. And the lawyers, of course, at the same time did a legal memorandum. So we had some for the lawyers and some for the activists, and it was very important. He proposed using the De Martens Clause and using the dictates of the public conscience as individually signed statements that would come to the court. And, of course, eventually we got 4 million there. But World Court Project UK pioneered this, and we pay tribute again to George if he's here, and Jean, but I don't know whether they are working too hard. But brilliant campaign, and they did 40 different languages for these declarations. Zimbabwe in 1992, the chair of the non-aligned movement opened the conference, and we launched the books, and we had a list of already at that time 90 New Zealand prominent endorsers, including our present Prime Minister. We presented those. The International Steering Committee was formed, and at the same time, the doctors had decided, and it was again led by some crazy Kiwi doctors, who went to the 1992 WHA and said, let's try and get a resolution through on the health and environmental effects. And it was sponsored by 14 countries at the time, but defeated at that time. And there are some of them. There's Eric Geiringer and George Salmon. And, of course, the team in 1993 was led by Anne-Marie Janssen from IPPNW. Absolutely key work that they did. And this was a cartoon. If it's your health you're concerned about, I'd advise you to drop it. That's the Americans holding on to the draft resolution. I hope you can read it. Very briefly again, the international strategies that were adopted. There's a small, motley little team, and this is the only photograph of the International Steering Committee. We didn't realise it was going to take off as well as it did. But that IPB said they'd look after the citizen campaign. ILANA coordinated the legal arguments and lobbying at the UN, and IPPNW coordinated the WHA. And the main thing was to encourage the non-aligned movement to submit a UN resolution, including use and threat. And Alan went to New York to help coordinate the lobbying. Again, have a look at this later. It's too much detail, but this was a dream we had that if we went to the media, we wrote letters to politicians, we lobbied, we got endorsements, we got declarations of public conscience, that was the people power, then we would choose a prominent person to hand these declarations when we went to the UN General Assembly in 93, and that would be handed over to the Secretary-General. Then we'd go in May 93 to the World Health Assembly and we'd lobby ministers of health. Then we'd go to the General Assembly and we'd just get to the court in 95. Well, it happened because of all the people power all around the world and all of you in the room who made it happen. But it was really exciting. We used the membership of those three main Nobel-winning organisations whose members, some of them, were actually ministers of health and foreign affairs. There were two draft resolutions prepared for the WHA and the UN General Assembly. We began compiling lists of endorsing organisations and prominent endorsers, and we began lobbying in capitals and having speaking tours. I think Rob went to about four countries right across Australia, Canada and other places. I know Alan went to South Pacific forums and lobbied people getting off. You saw someone when you were walking down the street, I think you were on the bus, and just jumped out and went and lobbied someone in the taxi. And I know Anne-Marie Janssen could speak Spanish, so she heard about the health ministers going for a ride in a bus. So she decided, oh, get on there. And she got five to endorse the WHA resolution by speaking in Spanish and getting the Latin American support. Very creative work, but it sounds like it's easy, but I want you to know it wasn't. And there's a huge amount of intimidation that went on that you can read about in the thesis. But they did succeed in 93 in getting a question through on the health and environmental effects of a nuclear weapon. It was approved with 73 for and 40 against with 10 abstentions. And then the International Court invited submissions from states due on the 10th of June 1994. Here's an example of some of the declaration presentations, and that's a conservative member of our parliament and a less conservative one receiving 22,000 declarations of public conscience in our parliament, and the big banners up the side of parliament as well, and it showed the spread of people from all walks of life. There were judges and, you know, bishops and ordinary citizens. We had a real mix of people. But extremely important, because that sort of thing meant that that minister, as he accepted the declaration, said, if it goes to the vote, we'll vote for it. And the media were there, got that statement out, and we were able to use that statement, weren't we, Alan, to show it to the Irish and the Swedes and the others and say, look, if it goes to a vote, that New Zealand will vote for it. But, of course, he got wrapped over the knuckles because he'd made policy on the hoof, as they say, and he shouldn't have actually done that. But that happened all around the world. The declarations were handed in. There's Peter Weiss, Hilda Leaney, when we did the declarations at the UN, and then again at The Hague. And at the General Assembly in 93, Zimbabwe took huge leadership on this, and I can't go into any detail on it, except that the countries that put themselves on the line desperately needed our support. And we were able to present the 100,000 declarations, the McBride appeal, the Hiroshima-Nagasaki appeal as well. And there were demarches going on by nuclear weapon states to capitals of not just the non-aligned movement, but also the Barton Group and the Western Group. So it was happening to Canada and others. They said they have never known intimidation like it. Alan and others will acknowledge that we had our homes broken into, or offices broken into, mail ripped open. It meant we were being effective. And it's still going on today, which is good. And in Indonesia tabled the resolution. The non-aligned meeting met all day. And again, I can't tell you all the anecdotes because we haven't got time, but there was amazing times when, for example, Hilda Leaney, the Minister of Vanuatu, left us standing outside as we were shaking hands with every delegate that went in. But she went on the inside and she said, I'm going in there to eyeball my colleagues, even though I can't vote. And Vanuatu took an absolutely key role in standing up to the non-aligned movement and saying, we're going to go ahead with this. That meeting was absolutely critical, even though the non-aligned decided that year not to press for final action and reserved their right to do it again. It was because the nuclear weapon states were linking the resolution with what would happen on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the Fission Cut-Off Treaty, and with the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So it's extremely important. I realise I've only got a couple of minutes. But 1994, we did get it through. Again, it sounds like it was really easy and you just had to lobby a few people, but it wasn't like that. The resolution did go through asking for the question on threat and use of nuclear weapons. Again, adopted 78 for, 43 against, 38 abstentions and 25 non-votes. And if you read the thesis, you'll see why most of those countries had to get out and not be in the room for voting, because they would have lost their aid and trade with certain superpowers if they hadn't voted the wrong way or not voted. And New Zealand and San Marino were the only Western states to vote for it. We had the declarations handed over at the World Court, and you can see many of the people here today are in that photograph. And in this one, gosh, it's a younger-looking... No, we won't say it. All of us looked younger in those photos. And very important that the Hibakusha were there as well. I must pay tribute to them and to the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who gave very moving accounts. Here are the countries and the numbers of declarations that they gave, coming to nearly 4 million. And you heard Judge Weeramantry saying there wasn't any room, I think, to store them. And I think ARC Moulton had to find a storage place for these massive boxes that came in from around the world. The oral hearings were held a year later. And there's the South Pacific delegation, who three tiny states all joined together. And I think Judge Weeramantry mentioned Lee John Eknalang's amazing contribution about the intergenerational effects. There's Peter, and I want to acknowledge Razali, Ambassador Razali, who became he was the Malaysian ambassador at the time, but became the president of the UN General Assembly later. And he was a real activist and very strong, standing up in his statement and talking about the non-aligned movement and how the pressure that was on them all. He was extremely brave to do that. It was the largest case to the World Court. 44 states, actually. I reread the thesis the other day, and it's actually 44 states and the WHO, four nuclear weapon states. It was the first time citizens and expert witnesses were allowed, and the millions of declarations, as you know. And there was also a meeting with the court officials with Indigenous peoples. And there's the opinion happening, and you can see Judge Weeramantry just here. Protests outside the court, which is also quite unusual, but it kept happening. And, oh, Fom, that's you. And that's the press conference. So you know the outcome. I like this one. If nukes are outlawed, only outlaws will have nukes. And there's lots more, and I'm going to whip through it because I want to finish with what Michael Crist said. Now, Michael was one of that motley team of six or seven of us in the IPB office that coordinated this thing from our offices and homes. And what he said at the end, I think, is just lovely. He said, "We created a new political forum, a new political opportunity which didn't exist before until citizens' groups decided that this was going to happen, and we created it out of nothing. It was an idea. It is we. It is not just lawyers, the doctors, or the Peace Bureau. It's no one group. It has been like 1,000 points of light." Thank you.